Solitaire Rose Radio, Episode 28, Jack Kirby, 1970 to 1972, The New Gods. There came a time when the old gods died. The brave died with the cunning. The noble perished, locked in battle with the old unleashed evil. It was the last day for them. An ancient era was passing in fiery holocaust. The final moment came with the fatal release of the indescribable power which tore the home of the old gods asunder, split it in great halves, and filled the universe with the blinding death flash of its destruction. In the end, there were two giant molten bodies spinning slow and barren, clean of all that had gone before. Adrift in the fading sounds of cosmic thunder, silence closed upon what had happened. A long, deep silence, wrapped in massive darkness. It was this way for an age. Then, there was new light. When I left off in the last Kirby episode, quite a while ago, Jack had moved to Los Angeles with his family. He had told the people at Marvel he'd done it for his daughter's health reasons, and that was a part of it. But it was also he wanted to get away from all of the stuff in New York. He felt that he could work better if he was further away from the office, and that they might give him more creative freedom. And that didn't happen. He was working at Marvel without a contract. He had been in negotiations with Martin Goodman for quite a long time. Pretty much after the 1968 copyright case around Captain America, where Martin Goodman promised Jack a number of things if he were to testify on Marvel's behalf. Kirby testified on Marvel's behalf, and afterward, Goodman did not deliver on his promises. Jack also was very unhappy about how his work was being treated. I went into detail on the story involving him and how Stan changed the story significantly from what Kirby had turned in. And if you look at Kirby's work after that, he gave very, very few of his new creations, his new characters, to Marvel. What Kirby told people at the time is he was putting them aside to use at a later date. Over at DC, they were going through a huge change themselves. The older writers had all been swept out when they tried to organize to get higher rates and medical benefits. They tried to form a union, and what DC's editorial staff and their ownership did in retaliation was they just quit using them. There was a short time when some of them showed up over at Marvel, but they really didn't fit in, and soon they left comics altogether. DC also had gone through a huge boom and bust period. The boom was the Batman TV show, which caused Batman sales to go through the roof, higher than they'd been since the 40s. And in many ways, saving Batman from being canceled. Afterward, however, sales started to tumble pretty fast when the Batman mania died down, and DC had kind of put a lot of eggs in their Batman basket. They also were losing ground to Marvel rapidly. Marvel was no longer being distributed by DC, so they could put out as many books as they wanted. In the early 60s, Marvel could only put out 8 books a month. And of course, Martin Goodman, being the Martin Goodman he is, would stretch that by putting out an occasional special or an annual or this, or he'd squeeze it as much as he could. But once Marvel got their own distribution deal, they were no longer tied to the 8 books a month they had under National's distribution. They exploded, putting out tons of new books, hiring people, their sales were up, they were doing different formats, they were doing different types of comics. They brought back the westerns, they brought back the teen humor stuff. Marvel just was exploding with the number of books they put out, hiring people left and right. But when Kirby left, Marvel, in many ways, according to the people who worked there, went into a panic, wondering what they would do without Jack putting out his books. What Jack did was, when he came to DC, he had a number of different plans in mind. I've read a lot of different things on what he had planned with the New Gods, with magazine distribution, with other things. I've heard that the New Gods were going to be, Kirby wanted it to be a finite series, that when it was done, it would be collected in albums, much like in Europe, where they would collect comics in hardcover. The Asterisk and the Tintin books were readily available. They would collect stories. They would have them as hardcovers and continuously published. There were also times when Kirby said that his plan was to start series and then bring in people to take them over, such as Don Heck. Or the one I always heard was he wanted Don Heck to come in and take over the New Gods. But he wanted to start these series, do them for a while, and have other artists take over, kind of like he did during the early days of Marvel. What DC wanted, they wanted him, he was contracted to produce a certain number of pages per month, and in a lot of ways they wanted him to come over and sort of replicate what he had done at Marvel, to come over and have the entire line start to sell better. What we do know is that Jack hired a couple of assistants, Mark Evanier and Steve Skeets. He was in California, Thousand Oaks, and what he did, he produced the entire package and sent it into DC, except in the early days, the inking was done at DC. Now, it took a while for, once the contract was signed, for Kirby to completely come over to DC, and what DC did is they started having house ads saying Kirby is coming. This was probably one of the earliest times in comics history where a publisher started hyping an artist. They started hyping a creator. Kirby is coming. It wasn't the New Gods are coming. It wasn't, you know, a character or a concept or a magazine. Nope. They hyped Kirby. Over at Marvel, they still had a lot of Kirby material because he was producing so much. But there were a number of books where things kind of ran out mid-story. Fantastic Four is the most famous one, where there was a half-done story that Stan had rejected and wanted changes on, but he didn't get it back to Kirby in time, that they reworked into an issue of the Fantastic Four a few months after he left. There was the Inhuman series he had started. He was writing and drawing it. And it ran after he left. And after Kirby was gone, they actually brought in Neil Adams to do. That's how big they thought the Inhumans were going to be. They always think the Inhumans are going to be big, and they never really are. I don't understand. But when Jack came to DC, the first thing he gave them were the New Gods. They were all of these characters he had created from 1968 and 69. And he, in his contract signing, he had worked through with Carmine Infantino what they were going to kind of bring them into. There is an urban legend that when Jack came on, he said, "What is your lowest selling book? I will turn it into your best selling book." And they told him it was Jimmy Olsen, so that's why they gave him Jimmy Olsen. Everybody who worked with Jack said, "Jack never talked like that." What Jack did was he asked what book they wanted him to take over that didn't have a creative team. It didn't have a regular creative team, because Jack didn't want to take away work from anyone. And Jimmy Olsen was kind of the book where, okay, we've got some extra Kurt Swan pages for this month, and we've got some extra this for this month. And it wasn't selling well. They were having rotating creators. So they gave Jack Jimmy Olsen. The other thing to keep in mind at DC was they were going through a big editorial change. Carmine Infantino was installed as their editor-in-chief. He was an artist, and it was the first time in DC's history an artist had been in charge of the company. In the past, if you look at DC's editorial history, it was people who came from editorial in magazines or book publishing. But many of those people, including Mort Weisinger, were kind of being cycled out. Their books weren't selling well. They were getting older. I could do an entire podcast just on Mort Weisinger himself. But I won't, because there are people who know far more about him. But Weisinger was being cycled out, and the editor who had blackballed Jack had also been cycled out. But that doesn't mean that the editors there didn't remember that Kirby had been blackballed, that they didn't still harbor some resentments. Julie Schwartz was at DC back in the 40s. Many of the other people who worked in the office had been there. You know, this is like 25, 30 years later. DC didn't have a lot of turnover during that time. So when Kirby came back, these were the same editors and the same staff who had made the jokes in the 60s. You know what Marvel's secret to sales is? Crappy art! Ha ha ha! And Jack also was not in New York. There weren't a lot of people who were allowed, as much power as he had, who weren't there in New York. It was long before you could fax or email or send stuff. Kirby had to draw the stuff and put it in the mail. And in the early part of his contract, he'd put it in the mail, and one of the things that Carmine Infantino did, he had Vince Coletta do a lot of the inking of Jack's stuff, because Vince had worked on Jack's stuff over at Marvel. And he felt the artistic continuity would really help with the sales. Now, two of Jack's assistants, Mark Evanier and Steve Skeets, were not big fans of what Vince Coletta did to Kirby's art, and they were firmly convinced that Coletta would erase things that he didn't want to draw. He would simplify drawings. He would get rid of stuff in the backgrounds. He would get rid of entire backgrounds, because Vince Coletta was an inker who thought, I get paid this much per page, so I'm only going to put in this much effort per page. The story was that he had actually boiled down how many hours it took him to ink a page, and he wanted a certain rate per hour. So if it was a simple page, he would actually spend a little more time on it, because it's, well, I get paid, I'm going to say $20 a page. It's not true, I'm just pulling it out of the air. But he says, well, I want to make $10 an hour, which, you know, back then's pretty good wages. I only want to make $10 an hour. They're going to pay me $20 a page. So I'll spend 2 hours a page. And if it takes 2 hours to ink every single thing on it, great. If it takes 2 hours and I got to leave some stuff out, that's fine too. Or the other story about Coletta was, if it was something that he found was too complicated to draw or he didn't want to ink it, he'd get rid of it. If you look at the Thor stuff, you can see where characters just aren't there. And one of the things Kirby had at the time that Marvel paid for, I went into it last time, he had a very early copy machine. And the reason for that was so Jack would know, okay, this is where we are in the story, so that he could pick up from where he left off without getting the notes from Stan. And what Evanier and Steve Skeets did is they looked through, because Jack never looked at his published work. He didn't care. Once he was done, once he had finished a page, it was out of his mind. It was done. It was on to the next page. But Evanier and Skeets started checking to see what was happening. And that's important later. But let's get into Kirby first showing up at DC. At first, they had a portfolio. And it was a lot of the preliminary drawings of the New Gods, as well as characters that didn't get used, and other Kirby art. DC sold this portfolio through the mail. I can't find any other example in 1970 of a publisher doing that. And it sold for a pretty high price for back then. So at least Carmine Infantino was very excited about nabbing Kirby and thought Kirby was the way that DC was going to reverse their downward sales trend. The first book Kirby came out was Jimmy Olsen. And it was part of kind of a reimagining that Julie Schwartz wanted to do with Superman. He wanted to move Superman away from the Mort Weisinger era and modernize the character. So one of the things Kirby did was he set up Morgan Edge as the new owner of the Daily Planet. And Morgan Edge worked for Darkseid. The other thing about Jimmy Olsen was there was a huge tonal shift. If you look at 60s Jimmy Olsen stories, they're very, very gimmicky. Giant Turtle Boy Jimmy Olsen, or Jimmy Olsen has to dress like a girl. What's Jimmy Olsen like when he dresses like a girl? It's wacky stuff. Most of the Superman books were really, really gimmicky back then, but Jimmy Olsen was one of the worst. I know that there are a lot of people who have a lot of fondness for that stuff. I find it utterly unreadable because it's all, okay, when does the hijinks get to the point where Jimmy Olsen hits his signal watch and Superman shows up and plays Deus Ex Machina to resolve the story? Oh, it's a new form of kryptonite that only Jimmy Olsen knows about, sort of thing. Kirby came in and instantly, Jimmy Olsen was a young adventurer. I can't remember him taking a picture of anything under Kirby. But it hit the ground running. Kirby threw tons of new concepts at the reader as he went through the series. Darkseid was introduced in the first Jimmy Olsen that Kirby did, as being kind of the mastermind behind some sort of evil plot going on. You had Morgan Edge as the new owner of the Daily Planet. He worked for Darkseid. He brought back the Newsboy Legion, but he did it in a scientific way. They were the same characters as the original Newsboy Legion, but we find out later that they're clones. He brings back the Guardian, which was a character that he had in the Newsboy Legion. And for those of us who read that and go, wow, he's bringing back these kid gangs from the 40s, it was only 20-some years ago that the Newsboy Legion was one of DC, National at the time's, biggest selling books. And superheroes had come back, other genres had come back. Kirby thought, well, if superheroes are going to come back, then the kid gangs are going to come back. But if you read those stories, you could see Kirby's love of science fiction bursting through. You had the DNA aliens, you had cloning, you had genetic engineering, you had Transylvania, which was a miniature planet that had horror monsters on it. And all of these things were just, every issue, a new idea. One of my favorites were when I read the comic that introduced the Harrys, which were these, guys on basically it was a super-powered motorcycle gang. And the story behind it was that Jack worked a lot at night, and he lived up on the hill, and down in the valley there was this motorcycle gang that all night they'd run their motorcycles and do stuff. And eventually Kirby went down there and asked him to be quiet because his family's sleeping and everything. And at this point Kirby was in his late 40s, early 50s. And most guys in their late 40s, early 50s, you got a bunch of young guys in leather riding motorcycles causing trouble. They're going to call the cops. No, Kirby went down there because Kirby was a tough guy, and I'm not making fun of him. Kirby grew up in gangs. And if you think the gangs in the early 20s weren't as tough as the gangs now, they were. They just didn't have the weaponry. Or the guns. But Kirby was kind of known as a very tough guy. He was a guy you didn't mess with. he went down to talk to him, not to, yeah, you sons of bitches, but no. Just, and he talked with them. He got to know them. And they made it into one of his stories. Kirby was always into youth, thinking that youth is where all the ideas are, according to Jack. And probably his time working in comics, he realized that the older guys, they're just recycling and basically taking care of things. And the new kids coming into the industry are the ones who, well, let's do this, and let's do this, and here's this new character, and let's try this. And that. So when you read Kirby's work, you can see his personal life coming into it, filtered through his creativity. There's a motorcycle gang having bonfires and making noise. They show up in Jimmy Olsen as a bunch of superpowered beings. They then... Jimmy Olsen was kind of the first of... Now, it's called now the Fourth World, but then it was the Saga of the New Gods. There were to be four books. There was Jimmy Olsen. There was Orion of the New Gods, which kept changing titles. If you look at some issues, they're called Orion of the New Gods, and others are just the New Gods. In the legalese, it was the New Gods. There were the Forever People, which was Jack's take on what hippies were like. It's very much, this is what the youth of America is now. And in some ways, it makes the book very, very dated. But in other ways, I look at it as, this is what the 60s seemed like to Jack Kirby. Youth with all of the drama and all of the creativity and all of the questing and all of the wanting to know, all kind of bundled together in a superhero-ish format. And then the last one was Mr. Miracle, who was a super escape artist. Mr. Miracle was based on artist Jim Steranko. Steranko. I don't know how it's pronounced because I've never met him. But he took this artist who he was friends with and turned him into a comic book character and told everybody, oh, well, this is Jim. This is Jim as a superhero. And with the new these comics, Kirby was kind of crafting an entire new DC universe. He used Superman because he was asked to use Superman. In many ways, he was asked to kind of reinvigorate Superman because Superman sales were down, the books weren't trending well. Nobody really kind of knew what to do with the character after Mort Weisinger had carpet-bombed them with silliness for 20 years. Julie Schwartz was coming in, although he wasn't completely in yet, but Julie Schwartz was coming in, and Julie couldn't do what he'd done with Flash and Green Lantern and everything. And when he came in on Batman, DC didn't think he really turned Batman around. They thought it was the TV series that had turned Batman around, and Julie's attempt at modernizing Batman hadn't worked. So they wanted to have Kirby kind of help modernizing Batman. I'm sorry, modernizing Superman. So Superman is in the Jimmy Olsen stuff, and he shows up in the first issue of the Forever People. And in that one issue of the Forever People, he gives me the Superman that I like best. There are different forms of Superman. There's the, you know, Superman is your wacky dad. There's the Superman is the strongest man alive. Superman is wish fulfillment. Kirby gave us Superman as the last being feeling very alone. Because Superman sees that there's an entire place, Supertown, where the new gods are from, where everybody has these superpowers, and he could finally fit in, and it's just out of reach. And if you look at Julie Schwartz, how he used Superman and how the writers use Superman, they latch on to that. They latch on to the last son of Krypton, the last of his kind, the only one who's really like him. And they carry that for quite a while. That's my favorite version of Superman. But as you read through the New Gods were four books that were connected and intertwined without crossing over that much. The only character who really crossed over was Darkseid, but there would be concepts from one to another. And it was all around this big plan of Darkseid, who was the leader of Apocalypse. You had the two bodies. You had New Genesis, the good gods, and Apocalypse, run by Darkseid. And they had gone to war. They were not at war for a while. There was some sort of pact we didn't know about. We find out later that stopped the war. But now Darkseid is starting it up again because Darkseid is searching for the anti-life equation. And in many ways, the anti-life equation and the search for that, to me, highlights Kirby's personal philosophy. When you hear anti-life, the first thing you think is death. And if you... there have been other stories that use the anti-life equation, and it's very clear that the creators don't quite grasp it, or they don't want to use what Kirby used, because the anti-life equation, you know, you can, it's a person, it's a thing, or it's this. But no, the anti-life equation is this mathematical principle that once Darkseid is able to get it, he can strip free will from everyone. No one has choice anymore. The opposite of life isn't death. The opposite of life is slavery. The opposite of life is having no choice. As you read through the New Gods, they have been collected a number of times. I think the current omnibuses are the best way to collect it because they collect it chronologically. They collect it in the order Kirby did it. It starts in Jimmy Olsen. And in Jimmy Olsen, you find out about what Darkseid's doing. You see Darkseid's minions doing things on Earth and what Earth is doing to counter it. In the New Gods, you see what the residents of New Genesis are doing to counter Darkseid. You also meet Orion, who's one of the New Gods but doesn't seem to fit for some reason. You have the Forever People who just, they've come to Earth and they're exploring. They're wanting to know. They have that very Kirby positive look at humanity. That humanity may be a mess right now, but they could be so great. And then Mr. Miracle, number one, opens up with him escaping from Apocalypse, coming to Earth, and kind of getting into a domestic situation with a former jail guard, Big Barda, who is part of the Female Furies, who were part of Darkseid's minions. The thing about the New Gods that is so great is Kirby is creating a whole new mythos. New characters are being thrown at you right and left. New concepts, new ideas. Every page, there's, if you look at DC from like 1978 on, what Kirby did in those 11 issues of the New Gods and 11 issues of the Forever People and 11 issues of Mr. Miracle and the 20-some issues he did of Jimmy Olsen, they have used so much of those ideas and so many of those concepts and all of that, that in many ways they did kind of rebuild the DC universe. The bad thing about those is Kirby was on his own for the first time ever. In the Golden Age, he'd worked with Joe Simon. In the Silver Age, he worked with Stan Lee. Now that he was on his own, he was just throwing stuff, concepts, ideas. The stories were great, but he never took time to kind of pause and develop anything. Ideas were being thrown at you at rapid speed, almost as if Kirby couldn't get them out fast enough. There was an unevenness to it at times. And I'll talk about that in a bit. But there was also Kirby, the two people who worked for him, Steve Skeets and Mark Evanier, had never worked in comics before. They were huge Kirby marks. So they weren't able to kind of go to him and say, hey, Jack, let's focus on this, to kind of give him some guidance. And I think every creator needs some guidance. When any creator is left to do whatever they want, they eventually, their flaws really become larger. And I love the New Gods. It's one of my favorite works in comics. I think The Fourth World is a spectacular work of genius, but there are issues where I just grind my teeth. But for every issue or idea that blows up and makes you shake your head, there's others that just boggle your mind at how great they are. Kirby felt so invigorated, so excited. He was able to do what he wanted. Now, at the time he was doing the New Gods, he also had come to DC and had pitched that he would do four magazines, because Warren's magazines were selling very, very well. Jim Warren was publishing Eerie, Creepy, and Vampirella. Mad was selling through the roof, and Kirby knew these were just comics in a different format. He also knew that the regular 32-page color comic wasn't going to be getting in the hands of the adult as easy as a magazine would. He looked at what Jim Warren was able to do in the magazines, and he felt he could do more adult-themed work. When he came to DC, the four black and white magazines that he was going to do were Spirit World, which would tie in with a lot of the horror and mysticism themes that were really big. In the Days of the Mob, crime stories, specifically crime stories set in the 20s and 30s. True Divorce Cases, kind of going back to the romance books he did, he felt that the rocky road to divorce was something that was going to be growing over the next few years, and he wanted to kind of do stories around that. And from what I have read, none of them were done, but he pitched not every one of the stories would end in the couple getting a divorce. Sometimes they would go through a rough patch and get back together. Sometimes they wouldn't. But he wanted to do like he did with Young Romance or the other romance books from the 50s, feeling that maybe it was time for that to cycle through again. Romance magazines and women's magazines were selling really well. He saw women as an untapped market. And then the last magazine that I've only seen a few pages for was to be called Soul Love, which would be romance stories with African Americans. He saw African Americans as an untapped market that comics were ignoring. And I could not agree more. I think that through the 70s, there should have been more aimed at that market. Because if you look at the heroes that were there, we all love Luke Cage, but if you read Luke Cage, it's you know, it's Superfly, it's Pusherman, it's blaxploitation. You get to Don McGregor's Black Panther, I think if you would have had more books like that, it would have served that market, especially when you read what a lot of people who were young at that time thought. I read Dwayne McDuffie's afterword in the Black Panther masterwork about how he, as an African-American kid, finally had a hero who wasn't exploitative. It was a hero with dignity. It was a hero who was just as big and heroic as the white heroes. It was a hero he could latch on to. Kirby was ahead of the game on that. He pitched the ideas, and from what everything I've read, DC kind of said, okay. They half-heartedly put out the first issues of Spirit World and In the Days of the Mob. They didn't put them out under the DC banner, though. And they killed the project pretty quickly. I So second issues of those never came out. They never got sales reports because you can't put out one issue and then, yeah, it's done. And the stuff that Kirby had done, they repurposed into their mystery magazines or some other stuff where it was redrawn. All the stuff from Spirit World ended up in their horror magazines. So DC kind of dropped the ball because Marvel made a lot of money off their black and white magazines in the 70s. DC could have been in before Marvel was. And they dropped the ball. Kirby, again, ahead of the curve, saying this is where the market's going to go. And who knows how it would have done if they would have stuck with it a little while. Could DC have challenged Marvel or even Warren? Could those magazines have lasted through the 70s and maybe kind of caught on because Marvel was doing horror mags? Everybody was doing horror mags. Kirby was looking at doing different genres that might appeal to different readers. As he did the New Gods, Evanier and Skeets pointed to how the work was being changed. Now, if you look at the Jimmy Olsen, one of the things that DC Editorial did, they redrew the Superman faces and the Jimmy Olsen faces. And they said they did that because they wanted consistency. There are differing stories as to whether Kirby approved of that or not. I've read stories where Kirby said it's part of doing business, Superman's theirs, I'm just borrowing him. There are others where they asked me to do this, and now they're making it look like they're boring old stuff. I would imagine that his thoughts on it changed day to day. There were some days he was okay with it because he wasn't working at Marvel anymore. And there were others where it was, why did you bring me over here if you're just going to try and put me in this box? But they were Evanier and Skeets were eventually able to show that Coletta was erasing background stuff. He was erasing art that Kirby had drawn. And Kirby asked that he be able to hire his own inkers, and he would just ship DC the finished package. That all they would have to do is do the coloring and the lettering, and basically he would package it like he did when they had the Simon and Kirby studio. He brought in Mike Royer and told Royer, just draw what's on the page. And if you look at Mike Royer's stuff on Kirby, or D. Bruce Barry, who also did some work for him back then, the art looks very different from what you're used to from Jack. Part of it is Jack's style was evolving, but the other part is what the inkers at Marvel did is they would bring their own sort of artistic sensibility. Joe Sinnott would give Kirby's art this really polished sheen. Other inkers would bring forth the dynamics. What Mike Royer did was he just gave you what Kirby had on the page. He didn't add, he didn't subtract. Some people like it more, some people don't. I used to not care for Royer's inks on Kirby, to be honest. As I've read more Kirby from the 40s and 50s, and I've seen more of the pencils and developed more of an appreciation, I appreciate what Royer did, and I thought it was perfect for the art at the time. I do wish there would have been someone to sort of change up how the different books looked. Because over at Marvel, Kirby had different inkers, so different books looked different. But you're not going to be able to change what's there on the page. You're not going to be able to change it. I talked a little about how Kirby had some misfires. One of the famous stories was the Don Rickles story. Kirby did a two-parter where Don Rickles and his cousin, Goody Rickles, showed up. The story was pitched to Don Rickles as, we want to have you in this comic because you insult the big guys. You insult Frank Sinatra. You insult who's bigger than Superman? And it was just going to be an issue of Don Rickles kind of being there to poke fun at Superman. But with Kirby, what he said when it was pitched and what he finally put on the page are two different things. And in a lot of ways, it's one of the, it shows Kirby's sense of humor. And it shows that Kirby's humor doesn't quite translate onto the page, in my opinion. It's a very odd story, and there's some funny bits. But when you get to the end of the two-parter, at no point does Don Rickles ever interact with Superman. there was another misfire, the Black Rider. The Black Rider was a African-American paralyzed war vet who, because of the war between Apocalypse and New Genesis, became the Harbinger of Death, and he looked like a guy on skis. This is very clear that Kirby was trying to recreate the magic he did with the Silver Surfer. However, the Surfer's design was very sleek and very simple, and you quickly get over the silliness of it's a guy flying through space on a surfboard. You also had Stan Lee, who put the pathos, just kind of buried the character in pathos and philosophy so that you would get past the silliness. With the Black Racer, you don't have either of those, and Kirby has this needlessly complicated costume. So here's a guy on skis with a helmet and armor and flying through the sky with ski poles. And it doesn't work. Not every idea is great, and not everything they did was brilliant. There is also an issue of Mr. Miracle that I think is one of the meanest things I've ever read. And I have to say that I find it really unnecessary. What Kirby did in an issue of Mr. Miracle was he introduced Funky Flashman, who was basically Stan Lee as a villain, and it was Funky Flashman and his manservant, House Roy, who was supposed to be Roy Thomas. And if you read Kirby stuff, even his humor seems, it's not mean-spirited. This issue was amazingly mean-spirited. It was pure venom. And when I first read it, it was, oh, well, okay, he's working out his stuff. But I've read the New Gods, all of them, many times. And I always cringe when I get to that issue. And every time I go through and read, it just seems more unnecessary and more mean and more just mean-spirited. It was at a time when DC had fallen to second in sales. So it came off even worse as, oh, this guy beat us, let's poke fun at him. Let's make him look like a joke. Let's point out that Stan has a toupee. Let's make Roy Thomas seem like a buck-tooth midget. It's just mean. It just doesn't work. But counter to that, you have that first issue of The Forever People, which completely reimagines Superman without being a, hey, we're doing a new origin and everything. No, Superman's a guest in the book, and it gives a new take on him, a brand new way of looking at Superman. You have The Glory Boat, which you could argue is the best of the New God stories and the best Kirby story after 1970. Which shows normal people caught in a war between gods. And shows the generation gap at the time and how that generation gap is timeless. And how even though people may not agree with each other, they may argue all the time, they may still have deep love for one another, that deep familial love. You also have the pact, which gives all of the background of the New Gods. It gives all of the mythos of where Orion comes from, where Mr. Miracle comes from, where the original war between New Genesis and Apocalypse comes from. In one issue, it gives it all there, and it reads like Greek myth. It reads like Roman myth. It's just this huge story that every time I read it seems even bigger. You've got the relationship between Big Barda and Mr. Miracle, which shows Kirby could do solid romance with strong women. All of Kirby's women in the New Gods are strong women. There aren't any women who are the Sue Storm. Oh, I hope Reed pays attention to my new haircut sort of thing. The characters in the New Gods are strong. They're interesting. They're mythic. The art is big. If you look, Kirby's doing these double page spreads. This is where Kirby really started doing the, you had your opening page and then you turn that page for that double page spread. And Kirby drew it so that it just leapt out at you. Those two page spreads are amazing. It's one of the things when I talk about digital comics to modern artists, they'll do the two page spread, but it's really, okay, here's one big image and a whole bunch of panels all over the goddamn thing. And when you're reading it digitally, it's like, okay, the page is just half the size. But when Kirby did a two-page spread, you'd open it up, and it would be this image that just blew up. It was big. It drew you into the story. It let you know that this isn't a fill-in issue. This is big deal. Kirby was asked to reimagine Dead Man. And the less said about that, the better. Kirby didn't want to do it. He hated the whole idea of Dead Man, but Dead Man was one of Carmine Infantino's favorite characters. So what Kirby did was he thought about it and he said, okay, this is a character who doesn't have a body. Fine, build him a body. Give him a damn body so he can do something. The story is that the New Gods did not sell well, and that is why it was canceled. The story is more complicated than that, and we're never going to know the truth. We're never going to know the whole thing. What has been said is that the New Gods sold well, but its return on newsstands was more than they wanted it to be. What many people who worked with Kirby at the time said, they published far more of a Kirby comic than they did their other comics. So while Kirby's comics were selling really well, they were printing up to two times a normal DC print run. And they based sales not on how many copies you sold, but the percentage that were sent back. So, let's say that you're printing 400 copies of Batman, and you sell 300,000. You print 400,000, you sell 300,000, you have a sell-through of 75%. Woo, it's a hit! But with Kirby, you're printing 600,000, you're selling the same 300,000, up, your sell-through is only 50%. It's a bomb. There are other people who say that the sales figures weren't really accurate because they would come in up to a year and a half after a book was published, and you didn't really know how something was selling till long after it was done. We're never going to know because they're never going to release those records to us, if they even still have them. What we do know is Kirby left Jimmy Olsen. New Gods and Forever People were canceled, both with issue 11. Mr. Miracle continued, but what Kirby was told was you can't have any of the New Gods stuff in it. You have to kind of reimagine it. What Evanier has said is when Kirby got the word that the New Gods was done, that he was upset, and then by Monday it was all right. What can I do next? My opinion, if you look at Kirby's work before the New Gods and after the New Gods, there is a massive difference. I'm not saying that his work after The New Gods wasn't great, but his work after The New Gods was not this explosion of creativity. It was not new characters being thrown at you. It wasn't big concepts. It wasn't big ideas. It wasn't as big, and it wasn't as universe-changing as The New Gods were. The New Gods were a massive explosion of creativity. And then it ended. The experiment only lasted about 2 years. Kirby had a 5-year contract. So what did he do for the rest of those 3 years? We're going to get into that next week, because I talked about The New Gods a lot more than I thought I would. If you want to read The New Gods, DC has published them in both hardcover and hardcover under the Kirby Fourth World Omnibus. Now, people will ask, why was it called the Fourth World? Was that something Kirby thought up? Kirby did not think up the phrase the Fourth World. Although later on, he said that, well, you know, at the time we were talking about the First World, which was the U.S. and Russia. There was the Second World, which was all of the countries involved in the Cold War. And then there was the Third World, the undeveloped countries. This was the Fourth World. If you go back and you look at the covers, the fourth issue of The New Gods, the person working on editorial who wrote the cover blurb wrote, "The Kirby's Fourth World of Excitement," in that the first three issues had each been their own world. Which story's true? I tend to think the second one. But again, we'll never know. But you can pick them up. They are in hardcover and softcover. My recommendation, even though they're more expensive, get the hardcovers. You're going to read them more than once. Your first time through, it's very, very different from Kirby under Stan Lee. In some ways, Kirby was kind of approximating that bombastic Stan Lee purple prose. But if you go back and you read Kirby from the 40s and 50s, he's also evoking that. He's using that same style of writing he used then. You also need to remember as you read them, Kirby wrote this as if it were modern myths. Not in that pseudo-Shakespearean stuff that they did for Thor, but Kirby wanted the dialogue to ring big. Now, there are some clunkers when it's very easy to tell when Kirby's doing exposition, which he can't do very well, where characters will introduce themselves, they'll say their own name, they'll give their personality sort of thing. Kirby wasn't a trained writer, so he didn't know the show don't tell rule. So there's some clunkiness to it. But I heard a description back in the 70s that just fits. And it's Kirby's scripting is word jazz. I opened this episode by reading the stuff at the beginning, the narration, the very beginning of the first issue of The New Gods. And when you read it out loud, it has a power to it. It may take you a little while to get into that rhythm of Kirby's jazz, but once you do, he's Dave Brubeck. He's awesome. There were some black and white reprints of the Kirby stuff as well, and there are two trade paperbacks of the Jimmy Olsen stuff. I wouldn't get those. I would get the omnibuses. There are four of them. They reprint the entire New Gods that Kirby did in chronological order, the way they came out on the stands, including when Kirby came back to finish the New Gods saga in the 80s. But it's a highly recommended series of books. It's one you're going to go back to over and over. It's one where you're going to want to linger over the art and see that the care and the power and the dynamics that Kirby put into that art. And in many ways, The New Gods were Kirby's last huge explosion of ideas. I'm going to get into the rest of Kirby's work at DC in the next episode. I thought I could fit it all in this one, but the New Gods is just too big. It's just too big and it's just too good. I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for being so patient with me as I put these together. There will be more. And yes, I am coming back to the EC stuff. And I want your feedback. Here's how you could give me that feedback. It's very easy to contact us here at Solitaire Rose Radio. All you need to do is email me at corey.strode@gmail.com. You can do that for advertising. Just put in the subject line advertising. If you'd like to be a guest, if you've got an interesting story, just put guest suggestion. Or if you just want to give feedback, it's corey.strode@gmail.com, subject feedback. You can also call and leave a message on the voicemail line. That number is 952-856-0519. Thanks. As well as feedback, I got sponsors, and sponsors help me bring this show to you, and hopefully they kick a little back to me. It'd be nice if I could wet my beak a little, as they say in The Godfather. So, here's the sponsors. Pretty much every form of entertainment has advertising, and this one is no different. Our first ad is for DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is the best web host in the whole known universe. I've been using them for 14 years. They've always been able to help. They have great services. If you need a web page, they are the best. Just go to dreamhost.com, and if you use the code CRAZY, that's K-R-A-Y-Z, you get $20 off your first year. Our second advertiser is graze.com. Graze.com is healthy snacks delivered right to your door so that when you're at work, you can avoid the vending machine. When you're home, you don't have to reach for the bag of chips. It's dried fruit. It's new ideas. I get it every 2 weeks, but you could get it more often. Great food at a great price. And if you use the reward code CORYS3R5P, your first and fifth boxes are free. That's CORYS3R5P. And if you're listening to this here podcast, you're one of the most good-looking people on the internet. And you don't want to trust your skin to just any old razor. So shave with the amazing razors you get from Dollar Shave Club. Every month, they send a box with your shave supplies at the beginning of the week or whenever you want. You can pop in a fresh blade and get that fresh blade shave. It feels fantastic, and it's just one of the many ways that you can maintain the good looks that everyone has come to expect from you. That's Dollar Shave Club. If you go to dollarshaveclub.com/crazy, it kicks a little back. All of these advertisers, they kick a little back to us, so we can wet our beak a little. We're not asking for much. We're not asking you for money. But if you need these things, go to our advertisers. They support this podcast. Thanks. Again, I want to thank you for listening. I want to thank you for taking the time to download. And let me know what you think. I thrive on feedback. I enjoy the feedback. It's why I'm getting back to the Kirby stuff. I was getting feedback that people wanted the Kirby stuff. So, I'll be back next week with more Kirby. Oh!